from KXJZ in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up in the program, progressive populist Jim Hightower in our studio. He's in town with his new book. Also, the River Cats National Anthem musicians. There's a whole bunch of new musicians doing the National Anthem for the River Cats this year. Two of them perform in our studio. And photographer William Obernesser. But first, on Follow-Up Friday, San Francisco officials shocked the world this week when they suddenly changed the route the Olympic torch would follow through their city. It was a response to the large crowds of protesters and supporters who'd gathered in San Francisco. What happened behind the scenes? A Sacramentan who was one of the torchbearers joins us. He's Sean Baumstark. Sean, welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be back again with you.
I say welcome back because Sean was on Insight last month on an unrelated matter. He was about to take part in a bike ride from Sacramento to Las Vegas to raise money and awareness for the disease Friedreich's ataxia. Well, how did you feel about running through such a big, animated crowd?
Before I got to San Francisco, I felt great, you know, being here in Sacramento and then preparing for the event. Then, of course, getting down there, it gets a little more... the reality becomes known that there are people that really just don't want this thing to happen. But being in the bus and in the caravan that day is still very exciting. A little nerve-wracking, and there's a lot of anxiety, but still totally worth every effort.
So you and the other runners were in a bus most of the time?
There were a couple different buses and several different vehicles that had other torchbearers in it. There were probably six or seven vehicles that had us all, but the majority of us were in two, you know, charter buses that were in the caravan all day.
And you weren't allowed to have personal things like cell phones with you, so
we
you couldn't communicate with the outside
to.
World.
Yeah,
we weren't supposed to.
There were a few things that got on there that probably weren't, you know, shouldn't have been on there, but...
Now, the torch was supposed to be carried up and down the Embarcadero. But that didn't happen. When were you and the others told that the route was going to change?
Probably about 10 or 15 minutes after opening ceremonies. They did the opening ceremonies as scheduled. Those went off great, but from what I hear and what we understand is shortly thereafter, the crowd got a little chaotic down by the ceremonies shortly after they took the torch off the stage. And so then that's when they started thinking we might need to go a different way.
And how did you feel about that?
You know, at first, it was a bummer at first. It was a huge disappointment because there were so many friends and family that came down, and they knew about where my slot would be, so they were posted up there so they can get video and film and pictures. But when the word came that we needed to change the route and there was no way to get them to where we were going, that was a disappointment because you knew that it's going to be very difficult to find pictures or to find video of that moment where you have the torch.
Did any of the other runners actually voice a complaint? You know, say, I don't want to change the route.
Not at all. Not on my bus. On the bus that I was on, which was about half the runners, the mayor is the one that jumped on the bus and explained to us what his ideas were and what
Gavin
he
Newsom?
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Yeah, Mr. Newsom got on there and said, hey, here's the situation. Here's what we're proposing. If you're in favor, we're going to change it. And he kind of gave us a little bit of opportunity to go ahead and say, well, let's be safe and go a different way, or let's fight the crowd and risk everything. So everybody said, you know, we're going to go where you say to go, Mayor, and we're just about running the torch. So,
do you think if everyone in the bus has said, no, we want to stick to the route, do you think he would have liked you stay?
You know, I don't know. He did say later at the end of the day that if we would have said, no, stick with the route as planned, that he would have, you know, done that. But who knows? You know, there's so much more that goes into play there. Because if we would have stuck with the route and got down there and things got completely out of hand, who knows what would have happened.
My guest is Sean Baumstark, a Sacramento man who was one of several dozen Olympic torchbearers in San Francisco. As you'll recall, the route was changed at the last moment because of all the crowds on the streets. What do you think would have happened if you'd stayed on the Embarcadero?
I think, honestly, I really do believe that... the demonstrators probably would have gotten a little too much to handle, and it may have jeopardized the entire run, and San Francisco may have just pulled it out with just a few torchbearers and then eliminated the rest of the run. But, you know, I'm glad we changed the route because I know the mayor and his crew were very committed to that torch passing through the city, so that meant doing whatever it took to do it, and if that meant changing the route, then... we were all in favor of changing the route because we wanted those few seconds or the few moments of running the torch. We weren't ready to give up yet.
Of course. Did it ever seem like it might be just canceled?
It did. It did just a little bit there in the beginning, but once he said, you know, look, let's go down Van Ness, go to Bay Street, and we can pull it off. We're just going to have to do it fast. We were all pretty confident, especially once the first people get out of the bus. Once we started the relay, we were all pretty confident that it was going to get pulled off just fine.
Where exactly did you run with the torch?
I was right at the end, but they had to shorten the route originally, so we get from 6 miles to three, so they had to put us up in tandem. So I was one of two at number 38 out of 40, so just right before the end of the relay.
That was in the Presidio?
Yes.
In the park?
Yeah, right before you got on the freeway.
And were there any protesters there?
Absolutely. There was a lot.
How did they get over there?
I have no idea. But, you know, once word did get around that we were moving, obviously, the helicopters were over the entire caravan, and you couldn't miss the caravan. And then there were some people that had, you know, phones. And once we started going down Van Ness and people realized what was going on, that were there, innocently just, you know, going about their day, not knowing that the caravan was coming, they started calling. So it only took about 2.5-3 minutes before everybody knew that we weren't going to the Embarcadero.
There was a rumor going around at one point that the torch had gone onto a boat. Was that ever talked about?
That rumor. That was a rumor. That never happened. As far as I know, if it happened, then we've all been tricked.
This whole thing was international news. Were you aware of how many people around the world were probably watching what was happening?
Not aware that the world was watching, yes, but how many, no clue. You know, that morning, a friend of mine, who also from Sacramento that ran the torch, he went down to do an interview and was swarmed by so many news channels because they saw his uniform, and a couple of them were European.
Yeah.
Stories or news channels, so then you kind of start to realize this is a big deal.
You have a cardboard box behind you that looks like it's the shape and size of an Olympic torch.
It's exactly what it is.
Yeah, and we're going to take a photograph of it a little later, so we'll post it on our website. So you get to keep a torch?
Absolutely, yeah, and a real one. It's not some phony or, you know, anything fake.
So you're all carrying your own torch?
Correct. That was the original plan. Of course, when we had to do the tandem thing, That changed a little bit, but we all still got the torch that we were supposed to carry.
Did you have any sympathy with the protesters who wanted to make their feelings known about their objections to how China does business?
Oh, absolutely. I had no problem with that. Like the mayor said a million times, everybody's got the right to free speech, especially, you know, in San Francisco upholds that First Amendment right very well. So for me, it was never, I was never angry or upset or anything at the protesters. They have the right to do what they were doing. The only thing that is concerning is just that every now and then they can, sometimes people just cross the boundary. And that was the only worry, is that a boundary would be crossed and it would jeopardize a lot more than just somebody's expressing their opinion.
Yeah. And very quickly, Sean, how did the bike ride go from Sacramento to Las Vegas?
The ride of taxi, too, went very well, very successful, a lot of awareness, and a lot more money than we had ever hoped for.
Really?
So it was a great ride.
Well, congratulations. And, on both the bike ride and the honor of being chosen to carry the torch, the Olympic torch. And thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
That's Sean Baumstark. He was one of many people from Northern California who were carrying the Olympic torch in San Francisco. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, populist Jim Hightower. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Progressive populist Jim Hightower is in town with his latest book. It's advice on going against the flow. The book is called Swim Against the Current. Jim Hightower is a former elected official. He served two terms as Texas Agriculture Commissioner. He's also well known for his witty turn of phrase, often directed against President George W. Bush, in his newspaper columns and his radio commentaries. Right now, he's in our studio. Jim Hightower, welcome to
Insight. Great to be with you, Jeffrey.
What do you make of this year's presidential election? I'd like to start with the Democrats. Do you like Clinton, Obama, or neither?
I like both. I like Obama most. As in my view, the significant thing about the Obama phenomena is not Obama, but the phenomena, the fact that we've got millions of people, especially young folks, and a lot of people who haven't been voting in a long time, excited about being in politics and believing that real change, not as a political buzzword, but change of policy actually is possible.
some people say that there isn't that much difference policy-wise between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. Do you agree with that?
I do. But I think what you have in Obama is in a way, uncertainty. With Clinton, you have pretty much certainty of what she's going to be as president. With Obama, I think there's great potential for him to be bigger than his policies are right now. And I believe that people who are supporting him, again, a huge outpouring, would flow into the White House with him, not just the usual political operatives, not just the special interests, but outsiders would be allowed inside, a new cast of characters in charge, and Obama has shown himself able to grow in office.
What do you think should happen to resolve the Democratic nomination process? Because it seems almost certain that neither Clinton nor Obama will have enough delegates going into the convention, which means it would then go to the superdelegates. There are all kinds of scenarios being talked about. What do you think should happen?
I think that the superdelegates, which I was once one of back in 1992, it didn't matter back then. This time it does. I think the one we should get rid of the superdelegate process in the long haul. But this time, I think the superdelegates should vote according to the people's expression as it stands.
In other words, they should follow the overall winner of the process.
Yes.
Opposed to, because some people say you should vote according to your district, according to your city, your state, whatever.
Yeah. I think the superdelegates are an anachronism. We don't need this little class of elites making these decisions. People are perfectly capable of making their own decision. And I think having made the people's decision, that the superdelegates have an obligation to respect that.
My guest is Jim Hightower, writer, author, progressive populist. His latest book is Swim Against the Current, and he speaks tonight at the Coloma Community Center in Sacramento. On the Republican side, what do you think about John McCain? He seems to, a lot of Republicans, especially conservative Republicans, don't seem too keen on him. What do you think of him?
Well, obviously, you respect his past, but there's a lot. You know, we haven't lifted that McCain log yet, and when we do, there's going to be a lot of ugly squirmies coming out of there. And I don't mean personal stuff. I mean his servitude to corporate interests. As chair of the Senate Commerce Committee, he has been in lockstep with the corporate lobbyists in Washington. Even though he has been a supporter of campaign finance reform on policies, particularly environmental policies, labor policies, issues like that, McCain would really, at some level, be an extension of what the Bushites have been doing for the last 8 years.
Doesn't pretty much anyone who's a major player in politics have some questionable associates?
Yes, absolutely. But it's a matter of volume. McCain has lobbyists essentially running his campaign. They're not running his campaign because they just love John McCain. They're in there for the long haul and to continue to get what they can out of that administration and expect to get a lot. And that would work against the interests of working families, of the environment, of consumers, and et cetera.
Is it much better to have pollsters and PR people running your campaign?
No. I think consultants are the worst. They should be taken out and drowned, figuratively speaking.
You ran a presidential campaign back in the 70s?
I made Fred Harris what he is today, a professor in Albuquerque. But it was a great campaign, a wonderful populist campaign. And, you know, even in these losing efforts, you set a tone, you lay some issues out, and also you create a new pool of talent. And that's what happened. I subsequently ran for office, and much to the amusement of the people of Texas, got elected a couple of times down there, and several members of Congress came out of that campaign, and again, issues were developed.
You've supported Ralph Nader in the past running for president. He's running again this time. If he asked your opinion, what would you tell him?
I have already told him, without him asking my opinion, that I don't think it's the right thing for him to be doing for himself. I don't think he's going to have much impact on this election. I think it becomes, he's becoming a caricature of somebody who runs too often. And this election, I understand what Ralph is saying, and I respect that. He's saying that if I don't raise these issues, none of the other candidates will. Well, that's correct. But this campaign is not really about issues this time. I mean, on a specific level, it's about a tone, it's about a transformation, a change in policy, broad policy, a change in direction of the country. We've got 81% of the American people now saying America's headed in the wrong direction. That's a pretty good majority. Mm-hmm. And that's what this campaign is about, is really shifting that direction, not the details of each piece of policy.
Do you think that Clinton or Obama, whoever emerges, is going to be weakened because of this extended political financial battle between them for the Democratic nomination?
I think it depends on how long it goes on. I don't think they have been thus far. This is why we have campaigns. And both of them are raising legitimate issues. I think they're a little petty stuff, particularly from the Clinton campaign, and needs to quit, and that seems to be abating a bit. But no, we're a strong people. Voters are able to, you know, sense, make decisions, make choices within it. So I think it's part of what democracy is. You get to talk about where you stand and your view of where the other person stands.
My guest is Jim Hightower. His latest book is Swim Against the Current. Even a dead fish can go with the flow. Why did you decide to write a book about going against the current, against the flow?
Well, again, when you got that many Americans saying that we're headed in the wrong direction, you need to begin to look at what people are actually doing about it. And that's the good news. That is not reported much by the establishment media. It isn't addressed by the political elites. In fact, out in the countryside, people are on the move. They're defying the corporate order, even though we're told that can't be done. As a friend of mine put it, who's a pioneer in the organic movement, those who say it can't be done should not interrupt those who are doing it. And those are the stories we tell 50-something folks out there in business, in politics, healthcare, banking, food economy, religion, living their own values and breaking away from those corporate tentacles. The late great humorist from the South, Louis Grizzard, once explained the difference that Southerners know between being naked and being necked. Naked means you have no clothes on. Necked means you have no clothes on and you're up to something. And these people are up to something. They're up to big change in their own lives, in their own family, community, business, whatever. But it adds up to a possible new direction for our country that again, defies the corporate order.
I checked out your latest commentary on your website, and it's titled House the Rich, and it's a satirical take, I guess, on the current housing crisis. I'd like to talk with you a little bit about that, about what, if anything, should be done. There's a lot of talk in Washington and among the presidential candidates, and it seems like no one can agree on what could and should be done, and there are all kinds of good arguments, from what I can tell, for and against pretty much everything. What do you think should be done?
Well, the people who got suckered, they're the ones we need to help. The mortgage hucksters, they don't deserve a bit of help. In fact, some of them deserve some jail time. But I think we've got a longer-term problem and something we also need to take this opportunity to address. Why is it we need subprime loans to people? Because we've knocked down the middle class. Because people aren't getting the wages that allow them to get a regular loan. And that's the bigger issue of what's happened to our country, is the destruction of the framework of the middle class. And that includes affordable housing. We have all sorts of housing being built around our country, but the bulk of it is, $500,000 and up. The condos, the lofts that are going up here in Sacramento and my town of Austin, all across the country. A firefighter can't afford to buy one of those. A teacher can't. So we're moving people out of the city who service the city. And we're changing the dynamics of a city to a luxury consumer segment of the population. You can't sustain an economy on that. We've got to rebuild the middle class.
You're usually associated with Democratic Party politics. You've worked for or with various Democrats for the most part. But a lot of these things you're talking about have been delivered or presided over or proposed by Democrats themselves. How do you see a path towards the kind of society you would like to see?
Well, again, it's got to come from the outside. No politician's going to do it for us. They're the ones who do it to us in the long haul. And you're right, no matter which party. I thought Bill Clinton's tenure was a disaster for working America. was not a strong Democrat. In fact, a more Republican light sort of approach to policies, and that hurt our party. And I think it didn't help the country either. Things like NAFTA, things like the Telecommunications Act of '96, none of that would have happened except for a Democrat pushing what amounts to a corporate agenda. So I think the only change that's going to happen has got to have strong grassroots support behind not just one politician, but a set of politicians. And by the way, that's happening in the countryside, too. We're electing many, many good people. We did in 2006. People demanded change. You know, that's the buzzword for this political season, but it was also what was happening in 06. People said, we really mean it. We want change on Iraq policy. We want change on the environment, change on from this tinkle-down economics that we've been having. And so we sent people like John Tester out of Montana to the Senate, Amy Klobuchar out of Minnesota, Sherrod Brown out of Ohio, Bernie Sanders out of Vermont. Number of good people got elected. They're in there fighting, but there's not enough of them yet. And so we just got to keep adding to that. My friend Willie Nelson puts it like this. He said, the early bird might get the worm, but it's the second mouse that gets the cheese. So we have to just keep pushing.
My guest is Jim Hightower. On your bio, it says, and I assume you wrote it, the true political spectrum is not right to left, but top to bottom. And I want to talk with you a bit about that, because you can be a conservative populist or a liberal populist. I mean, it seems to me there's a right and a left wherever you are on the top to bottom. How are you different from, say, a conservative populist?
Well, I don't think there really are conservative populists because most conservatives, like Rush Limbaugh, likes to call himself a populist. But unless you're taking on economic power, you're misusing the term populism, because it is an actual movement.
Would you say Pat Buchanan is? He talks about economic interests.
At some levels, yes. Mm-hmm. He is. But I think that's what people are. I don't think people are one-dimensional. I am opposed to NAFTA and CAFTA and the new Colombian trade and the WTO and all that. Well, is that a liberal or is that a conservative position? And so I think people are mixes of things. And what people I'm talking about, when I first started to run for office in Texas, people in my state, the liberals said, oh, you can't run for office. The state's too conservative. And I knew they were talking about people like my father, my old daddy. Got to beware of Texans telling daddy stories, but I had a pretty good one. And if you went up and knocked on his door and asked, are you a liberal or a conservative, he would have said, I'm a conservative. But if you talked to him about what the bank holding companies were doing to small businesses like his, if you talked to him about the power of the chains and the oil lobby down in Austin, then you scratched a William Jennings Bryan, an economic radical, really, mad as hell. So, again, to me, it's not right to left, which is theory, ideology, and that divides us. It's top to bottom, where you live. And a good 80% of the American people know they're not in shouting distance of those powers.
Presidents are assessed and reassessed over the years, the decades, even the centuries at this point. So even though the current President Bush is very unpopular for the most part, no doubt he will be reassessed and reassessed again by historians. How do you think he'll be remembered?
As a loser. I mean, just a pathetic president and very likely the worst president in our history. A guy who shredded the Constitution, who had the arrogance to try to create an imperial presidency, which is anathema to all of the founders. The very idea of the founders was to restrict executive power, and a guy who then went after was. Really a corporate wet dream. Just any fantasy that a CEO has comes true if you put money into his pockets. Regulatory policies, trade policies, environmental policies, right across the board. He's been in service to the very wealthiest people and refused to lift a finger for the people who actually need help in our country.
And as a Texan who lived in Austin for a long time, you probably have been known him or known of him for quite a long time.
Oh, yeah.
What was your first impression of him?
A lightweight. I mean, and that's how it was known in Texas.
This is when?
This is in his first gubernatorial term. So 1994,
I believe
it was, yes, that he came in. He had been, Bush is, you know, he's not stupid. I think that's not right, that assessment of him. You know, he's not, doesn't have the IQ for much heavy lifting, but that doesn't mean that he's stupid. He knows his role, and his role has always been in his business ventures and then in politics as the a guy with a bankable name and a good front guy, amiable. And likable, and so that's why people got behind him. People who have an interest in what government is going to do, and that's who put him in the governorship. He served those interests very loyally, and then those same people went to the lobbyists in Washington and said, "We got a live one for you. You better get behind him." And they did. A very unique thing happened in the 2000 race in the Republican primary. The lobbyists chose very early on and raised millions of dollars for him in just. In group meetings, but first one at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
Jim Hightower, writer, author, progressive populist. His latest book is Swim Against the Current. He speaks tonight at the Coloma Community Center in Sacramento. It's a fundraiser for Common Cause. Jim Hightower, thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you. A joy to be with you.
This is Insight. It's the home opener tonight for the River Cats, Sacramento's AAA baseball team. This year, the Cats have lined up 25 singers and other musical acts to perform the national anthem. Auditions were held in an empty Raley Field late last month. Two of the winners, singer Dallas Johnson and sax player Eugene Peeble, stopped by our studio today, ready to do the anthem for you. First, I asked the River Cats promotions manager, Jeremy Neiser, what they were looking for in the tryouts.
We almost did it like a American Idol type-esque. We're looking for the best of the best, and I think out of these, the 25 that we selected, these were one of the top two guys here. So it was 110 folks we listened to, so it was pretty intense, that's for sure.
My goodness. Well, let's bring in our musicians then. Dallas Johnson, singer, and Eugene Peebles, who plays the sax. Dallas, Eugene, nice.
How you doing, sir?
Thank you.
Dallas, tell us about how you heard about this and why you thought you could do it.
Well, to be honest with you, I listen to the news every day, and they said come and try out for the River Cats Idol. So I got down there, and they told me that they had too many people because you were supposed to do it online. And Jeremy and the other guy was nice enough to let me try out and hear me sing, and the rest is basically history.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Have you done this before, sung the national anthem in public?
No, sir.
Anything even approaching it?
Well, you know, I love to sing, and I just never tried it. And then when I said, you know what, man, this is it's time. And I mean, God is good.
And Eugene Peebles, you've done this kind of thing before.
Yes, I have done it before.
Give us some idea of your experience doing the national anthem and similar songs in public.
Okay, I'm going to start with my latest one. It was for the Sacramento Kings, November of last year. Went very good there. And then prior to that, I was living in St. Louis. There I performed for the St. Louis Cardinals, the St. Louis Blues hockey team, the Ambush soccer team. So I've been around and done it quite a few places before.
So you've played, you've done it for many sports.
Yes.
In more than one city now. Well, let's start with a vocal version of the national anthem. Dallas, you're going to sing it for us.
Yes.
And before you get up to sing it, just tell us what the challenge is in singing the song, because it's difficult.
To be honest with you, the challenge for me is just being natural with it. You know, I feel sometimes people, you know, you might add a little bit too much to it and throw it off. I'm going to just use my voice and let it, you know, sing, you know, let it speak for itself, because that's what it's all about. It's just a heart feeling thing. You know, people say it's hard, and I sang it for a customer the other day, and they were like, "Oh, you're going to kill it." So that's my goal, is to do the best at it.
Well, we're going to pick up on a word you said there, customer. What do you do? What's your job?
I work for Walker's Business Products out of Placerville. I deliver to the greater Sacramento area, which El Dorado, Cameron Park, Shingles, you know, it's all over, and I get to sing to all my customers. They love it. It's a blessing, you know, because a lot of people could turn it down, but they don't. So that it's a good thing.
Well, you're going to sing for us, and we look forward to it. Take your place, please. This is Dallas Johnson. He's one of the people who are going to be performing the national anthem at River Cats home games this season, and here he is.
Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light. What so proudly we hailed at the twilight last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight, o'er the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming, and the rockets red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. Oh, say that star spangled banner yet wave for the land of the free. And the home of the brave.
Thank you.
Oh, that's...
Play ball, play ball.
That's great, Dallas.
Thank you very much.
Are you a trained singer?
Honestly, I've trained my... my mother died, like, it'll be 14 years next week. She died a couple days after my birthday. And when I turned 24, it was... when I truly knew I could sing, because she asked me to sing Whitney Houston, I Always Love You, at her funeral. I said, yeah, you know, 50 years from now, I didn't know I'd be singing that song 2 weeks later. And I did, and it all started from there, to be honest with you.
I noticed that you have a cross around your neck. Do you sing in church?
You know, I haven't been to church. It's funny. I'm from St. Louis, Missouri, born and raised. And when he said St. Louis, I just lit up. I just, you know... my aunt, she says, you have to go to church. I said, but, you know, I'm a Baptist. I haven't found, you know, I could still believe and not go to church. I feel, you know, if you just have faith in God and what he can do for us as people, and us as people sticking together, that's what it's all about. It makes the best come out of everyone.
And you have a Kings t-shirt on. Are you hoping to do this for the Kings as well?
Well, you know what? I hope to try out for the Kings and, you know, sing the national anthem. Actually, I could play like them. No, I'm just kidding. No. But no, I...
right now.
You know, no, I just... I want to try out for the national anthem at the Kings. And, God has plans for me, and I don't know what they are. And it's just to be happy, grounded, and just be real to people.
Now, if the Kings want him, they'll have to call me first, because okay. I'm now his agent, by the way.
Good looking.
Yeah. And Dallas, when do you sing for the Rivercats?
June 14th.
June 14th. Great. And Jeremy and I, are most of the people who are performing the national anthem singers?
Yes. Actually, Eugene's the only one that plays a musical instrument. We have a quartet, so there's four guys for that group. A lot of young girls, older girls, a lot of middle-aged guys and some young guys. A good mix of folks. And Eugene's actually the only instrument player. So.
And Eugene, that's the sax. When did you first pick up the sax?
I first picked up the sax back in 1976.
So you've been playing for a while.
Correct.
Tell us how you got to the saxophone.
How I got to this point, my story starts back when I was 10 years old, riding a bicycle, and I had a major bicycle accident, a head injury, where the doctors had gave up on me. But they told my parents, Mr. and Mrs. Peebles, if Eugene survives, he'd most likely be in a vegetative state. But my parents, God-fearing individuals, would come to me at my bedside. In particular now, credit goes to my father. He would come and say, Eugene, you come through this, I'm going to get that instrument that you wanted. And at the time, it was an organ. They couldn't afford it. We were from a small suburb of St. Louis called Kinloch.
And, Dallas knows Kinloch.
Wow.
Kinloch, Missouri. small suburb there. But we were things were very tight economically for us. But thanks be to God, 10 days and went through, I was unconscious. But then I came back around. The Lord blessed me to come through that. And my father kept his word. They couldn't really afford it. But then he bought that organ, a Hammond organ for me. Then shortly after that, I was starting to get better. Hey, Father, hey, thanks for the organ. I think I like to play a saxophone also. So he talked with my mother, and shortly thereafter, they bought a tenor sax for me. And that's when things really start coming for me.
Do you still play the organ as well?
Yes, I do. I'm an outstanding Hammond B3 player.
Yeah.
And I'm looking for the opportunity to show my talents with that in time.
Do you play, what do you play other than the national anthem and God Bless America and songs like that?
Well, as a musician, I try to keep myself well-versed. When I went to college, Central Methodist University in Missouri, anything from classical music to rock and roll and jazz. So I try to be versed in all types of music.
He's yeah. playing the Flintstones theme song in the other room, by the way.
He was. Well, right now we're going to ask Eugene Peebles to play the national anthem for us, if you will.
Okay, I sure will. Thank
okay.
you.
So this is Eugene Peebles getting in position to play his saxophone, play the national anthem. He, like our other guest, Dallas Johnson, will be performing the national anthem at a Rivercats home game this season. Eugene will be playing the July 3rd game. That's Eugene Peebles. Dallas, St. Louis guy, sounds pretty good in the sax, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. We're going to have to hook up here. This St. Louis connection in the house.
We didn't even know it.
Midwest connection. Isn't that something?
Dallas, what was it like auditioning for this? Because the ballpark was empty, I guess, except for just a few dozen people, probably.
Well, you know, the funny part was it was I was just glad that they said, hey, come and try out. Because after, you know, they told me that, you know, they already had 100 people. And I was like, ah, man, you know. But I got the chance to do it. And once I got out there on the field and got the feel of their microphone, oh, man. I was like, ooh, it's concert in the park right here with the mic. It was just a beautiful sound just coming out.
Eugene, you have experienced doing this in front of huge crowds. What's it like when everyone goes silent and the spotlight's on the musician who's just about to do the anthem?
It's a very good feeling, very positive feeling, and it's good to know that, to say, hey, the Lord has blessed me with this talent, and I'm going to illustrate what the Lord has done.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You both have the St. Louis connection. Could you tell us how you ended up in California or came to California? Well, Dallas is laughing, so we'll have to start with you.
A woman.
No, said.
My son's mom... 19 years, you know, my son will be 19, so it's been a long time. But you know, that was then, and this is now, and now it's time for me to show what God has given me and to share it. You know, it's a blessing.
And what about you, Eugene?
Well, mine is almost through a woman also. What happened in my situation? It's due to my wife. She got a call one day. She's a nurse, and she got a call from a recruiter. Said, "Hey, we could definitely use your skills out here in California." So she and I, we went home and talked about it and discussed and prayed on it. And so here we are now.
Well, Jeremy, you said at the beginning of the interview that these are two of the top ones that came out of the tryouts, and we heard them and are very, very impressed. But you got some other good people lined up, too?
Absolutely. We've got a lot of younger girls who are under the age, younger than teenagers, some young girls, and then we've got some older folks as well. Opening night tonight, 7:05 game time. Gates open up at 5. We actually did another kind of audition process with another local radio station, so we had a lot of fun with the TVs and the radio and the media for this. This has been a lot of fun, but we've got some good group of folks coming out. I think our fans are really going to enjoy it, so...
Very nice. Well, thank you all for coming in. We wish you the best for your respective performances. Dallas Johnson of the June 14th Rivercats game, Eugene Peebles, the July 3rd game, and the Rivercats in general. Jeremy.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, photographer William Obernesser. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Go to our webpage, capradio.org, for photographs of our previous guest, Sean Baumstark, with his Olympic torch. I'm going to take a moment here to congratulate one of our associate producers, Jason Treadway, who was recently honored at the Journalism Association of Community Colleges Conference in Los Angeles. He won an honorable mention in two categories, sports photo and news photo. The paper that he works for, The Current at American River College, also took top honors. There's an exhibit of poignant black and white photographs this month in Sacramento. They're a collection of new landscape, still life, and architectural images by photographer William Obernesser. Tomorrow evening, there's an artist's reception at the Asylum Gallery. This afternoon, the artist is in our studio. Bill, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Why do you like black and white photographs?
Well, yeah, every photographer, I think, is doing a lot of the same thing. You're out looking for subject matter, and from there, we all do a lot of the same thing. You're going to frame it. You're going to look for light. You're going to look for the juxtaposition of the objects within the subject. And so one thing I do is take out the color. And, I mean, just to me, it's pure personal taste. It affects the impact in a lot of different kinds of subject. It increases the impact. I notice your hallways here are full of beautiful black and white images of musicians. And, you know, I personally think that if they had been in color, they would be have less impact.
Now, those are portraits, by the way, from the Monterey Jazz Festival. You take the color out, and you say that in your website, that you use Photoshop to take the color out of what were color photographs.
Sure.
What changes?
Well, it's kind of a technology thing, I think. I mean, I don't mean that in a bad way, but with the typical modern digital camera, you capture the most digital information by taking a color photo. So that gives you the most flexibility in Photoshop then to create the best possible image. So although I don't do a lot with Photoshop and am far from a Photoshop expert, I know I'm bringing in the best raw materials by taking a color image. So it's kind of, you know, I think it's a technology thing.
Before digital cameras, did you tend to take actual black and white photographs?
Well, you know, I think maybe the first camera I ever had, that was the kind of film that was mostly around. And then later I took color photos. But I only really decided to get serious 4 or 5 years ago. And by that time, there were some good digital cameras out there. And I got more serious, kind of contemporaneous with the rise of digital.
Mm. My guest is the Sacramento photographer, Bill Obernesser. There's an exhibit of his black and white photography showing in Midtown Sacramento at Asylum Gallery. There's an artist's reception this Saturday from 6 to 9 p.m. And some of Bill's photographs are on our webpage, capradio.org/insight. They're the black and white ones, not the color ones of Sean Baumstark. Let's look at the first one that's on the bottom left. And these are blasted trees, I guess. The photograph is called Stumps. Where is this?
This is on Salmon Lake up north of Highway 89. I'm not sure if it's Plumas County or Sierra County. I think it's probably Sierra County. It's an area called the Lakes Basin Recreation Area. Lots of beautiful little lakes up there, fairly easily accessible by hiking. And it's a place that I go to look for subject matter.
And why did you choose this? The reason why I ask is that although it's obviously a real-life natural scene, it has a very abstract quality.
Yeah, I think, you know, I have some tendencies that way with the natural environment, but try to create something that has a somewhat abstract or maybe even going toward the mysterious quality. This to me, you know, I talked about the things that every photographer would do. I mean, this is mostly about framing what's in and what's out. It's a very, you know, small piece of the area that I was looking at, but the reflections, not just of the stumps, but then of the live trees in the far background and the roots, obviously, just make it an interesting photo to me.
The frame is, of course, something that you're imposing on it. How do you decide what you're going to frame when you're scanning a 360-degree horizon?
Well, that's the one of the creative steps, I guess I would say. It's instinctive. But let me tell you, in case there might be someone laughing at this part, sometimes you get it home and you frame it in the computer. In other words, the original image had more in it than this one.
Really?
Sure.
What did you take out?
Oh, I think there was probably more above what you're seeing there, probably more stumps, more rocks, more trees. But it seemed ultimately better to kind of bring it down and focus on what you see there.
To focus on the tree stumps and the reflection in the water.
Yeah, and the roots as well. I think the roots are a big part of it.
They are. They look like they're trying to get back into the water.
Right, exactly.
The next picture along is really quite dramatic. It's called Union Pacific, and it's a long-distance panorama of mountains, several layers of mountains, and then there's a train going across the near distance. Where is this?
This is in the Sierra Valley. Actually, it's not far from the other one. This is, let's say, between Portola and Reno on Highway 70. So it's really more part of the Great Basin, although it's in California. It looks more like Nevada, really, high valley. This is another thing I like to do. I'll go back to the same place from time to time, and the first time you do okay, and you see some places you want to come back to, and the next time you get them, and you benefit from going back to the same place.
The train is probably, I don't know, maybe 5% of the total image, but it would be a completely different photograph if not for that train.
Right.
You might not even have taken it.
Right, right, or kept it. I throw away a lot. But, yeah, that juxtaposition, the nature, and then the train slicing through it all. That's a big part of what makes it interesting. The layers of mountains, of course, are interesting, but the train makes it for sure.
It seems grainier than the previous photograph stumps. Is that deliberate?
You know, I've had some comment on that, and I guess I would have to say it's not deliberate. I can't really explain that too much more. I will say this again. I framed in the computer, and it's probably a relatively smaller part of the original image than the prior one was, and that probably has something to do with the grain issue. But I think it does all right for the subject matter.
Oh, it does. I really like the grainy quality, but there you go. And then the final photograph from you that's on our webpage, capradio.org/insight, is a close-up of two hands, apparently of an older person playing piano, and it's called 88. Is that the age of the person?
That's right. They tell me that's the number of keys on a piano, too, although I couldn't swear to it. So, that's my father-in-law. He was 88 years old. He's still living. He's older now. But, my father-in-law playing the piano at Christmas time, I think, a couple of years ago.
I like the fact that the left hand is blurred. It conveys such movement.
Yeah, that's why this one made the cut, a big reason why it made the cut. I mean, there's some interesting lines and shapes here as well with the keyboard being so dominant. But yeah, you definitely have the sense of movement there. A lot of people like that photo.
What does he think of it? This close up of his hands.
He's okay. not much enthusiasm, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I told him I sold a couple. Raised his enthusiasm 4 or 5%.
How old were you when you first took a photograph?
I remember my first camera, I think probably 6, 7, 8 years old, something like that. It was called an Ansco Cadet. For some reason, I remember that, and you can get them on eBay, but, you know, I wouldn't advise it. They don't make the film anymore that those use.
On your website, you say old 127 film. I'm not sure what that means.
Yeah, it's roll film. It's about twice the size of 35 millimeter. You can get it from a couple of places off the net, but it's not commonly manufactured in the U.S. So you get a bigger negative than you would get with 35 millimeter film.
What do you think about the move to digital photography?
Oh, well, that's, you know, it's a big part of my being able to do what I do and enjoy it. I mean, I think it's fine. I don't think you'll ever completely resolve the argument of which is better or which yields better results, because when you get into the realm of taste like that, you can never resolve those arguments. But more and more people are crossing over and saying that, that under the right circumstances, the quality differences are imperceptible, but all to the, except all the most extreme nitpickers.
Mm. And I'll just note that you're a software consultant for a long time. That's your day job.
Right.
Does that predispose you to digital technology?
Well, you know, maybe, I don't know. I mean, what you can do with digital, I mean, you're basically replicating the complete production cycle, including darkroom. I mean, the computer is the darkroom. You're doing those things on the computer. So the idea to have control over the complete production cycle, including the darkroom and printing and so on, that's appealing. And I think it's appealing to anybody who's serious about photography. That's why a lot of people still have darkrooms.
Mm.
So it's to have a darkroom, that's too much work for me.
William Obernesser, a Sacramento photographer. There's an exhibit of his black and white photographs at Asylum Gallery, an artist's reception this Saturday evening from 6 to 9. Bill, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. I enjoyed it.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Insight's theme was composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Today's associate producers, Jason Treadaway and Sochi Lopez. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Our interim producer, Robin Souza. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Our executive producer is Carl Watanabe. Thank you for joining us.